Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick. And Rob, I am so excited for the movie you picked today because it is our very first Weird House Cinema leather diaper barbarian movie. I can't believe it's taken us this long to do one because the LDBM is a almost perfect subgenre, well suited to I think our sort of knowledge bases and tastes. And one of my favorite things about the leather diaper movies of the 80s is, yes, they have a basis in the sort of Conan thing. You'll have a strong guy with muscles wearing a loincloth. He carries a sword or an axe, or maybe he just wrestles or something. But what I love about the movies like this from the 80s is that they so often start mixing genres in a bizarre, haphazard, almost blindfolded way. So the pinnacle of this, I think I've mentioned on the show before, is a movie called Your Hunter from the Future, in which a Conan-type guy, muscle dude in leather diaper, does battle at the end of the movie with Darth Vader. But this one we're going to be talking about today is, in fact, a Hercules movie where Hercules fights robots.
Yes, this is okay. So it's definitely a sword and sandals muscle man movie.
Yeah.
But it is also very spacey in a way that doesn't quite. It doesn't go so far as to say this is science fiction Hercules. It's still grounded in some sort of mythic sensibilities and in an idea that we're in antiquity, but everything is also just totally. I was thinking of it. It's like, what if Hercules and stories of Hercules were just totally Italian space disco, but without the Italian space disco music, but just
right.
That sense of like glittering, sparkling cosmos and sweat and and sexuality and so forth. That's what this movie feels like.
It also has that Italian disco sci-fi sense of. It's a movie where they don't even try to hide the strings in the special effects shots. Mm-hmm. So you'll see there's the jar from which all creation emerges when it explodes in space. And so they have a special effects shot where there's a jar floating in a star field and then it blows up. But then you see pieces of it are just dangling from strings and they leave it in the shot. And
yeah,
I high five for that.
Yeah, the effects in this film are ambitious, but often imperfect, but in a way that has real charm to it, you know?
I won't say that many of the effects in this movie look great, but I did enjoy them.
Yes, they're very enjoyable. They're often different from, like, you go into a film like this and you expect, you know, special effects that don't quite knock it out of the park. Uh-huh. But this one, it goes in some directions you don't really expect. There's a lot of sort of transparencies and a lot of things sparkling and sort of exploding with electronic synth mm-hmm. that you're not expecting to explode like that. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, but there's another thing we haven't even mentioned yet. So this is Hercules 1983. Mm-hmm. Starring Lou Ferrigno as Hercules. Mm-hmm. You might know from playing the Hulk on the old TV show, though I never saw him in that. I think I know him mainly from the movie Pumping Iron, which is a documentary in which he just plays himself at the weightlifting competitions. Mm-hmm. And in that, he's sort of the underdog character, and he's squaring off against Arnold Schwarzenegger, and they're both pumping and explaining why they pump better. And but anyway, so this is Hercules 1983 starring Lou Ferrigno, but this is also a Canon Films picture. This is a Golden Globus movie. And so whenever you see the Canon Films logo, certain thing that suggests something about the flavors that are going to follow. You know, Canon Films is famous for, in this period in the 80s, making movie after movie that are in the genre that I would call poster first. You have a poster before you have a script, and the poster is almost always a guy with a machine gun and then some other things in the background.
Right, right. Yeah, there's often a very macho feel, just all things 80s wound up in a Canon's film. And I can't remember if we've actually covered a Canon film on here before. But I'm sure if this is the first, it won't be the last.
Oh, surely not. Okay. So yes, Hercules 1983, Canon Films. It is at its heart, yes, it is a muscle guy movie.
Absolutely. A shining jewel in the long cinematic tradition of muscle man movies. The basic principle of these films is, of course, you usually have just a bare-chested muscle man hero who must battle evil and save the day, generally with just his brute strength. The flavor is generally mythic, you know, sword and sandal comic book stuff. You know, sometimes it goes in more of a sci-fi direction. For example, movies we have covered on Weird Al Cinema, Hands of Steel and Arena, those are both to a certain extent muscle man movies. We both have, especially mm-hmm. Hands of Steel. But for the most part, we're dealing with stuff that's more sword and sandals, sort of strongman shenanigans. You cast a bodybuilder, and then you just watch the movie come to life around that physique.
Right. I do agree that is the heart of it, is like a character who must use their brute strength in order to defeat the villain. So they're swinging a sword, or they're wrestling, or they're wielding a hammer. You know, it's the barbarian type, the Hercules type. But there was a strange phenomenon in the 80s, I'm sure you'll know immediately what I'm talking about, where the muscle man movie and the guy with the machine gun on the poster movie sort of merged. A great example of this is Commando, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, where the premise of the movie is that the hero is a man who shoots guns at the bad guys, but they also just get a bodybuilder to play him. So the main characteristic of the hero is that he is, you know, 800 pounds of stiff beef, but he also just, like, you know, uses guns.
Yeah, yeah. And it's important to note the sort of bodybuilder turned actor thing, the sort of non-actor that's brought into play the character in these roles. I feel like it is really vital to the whole recipe for success here. Like, you don't want too much of a thespian in there, no matter how muscular they are. You know, that's why I could only be so interested in the idea of The Rock playing Hercules in the more recent Hercules movie. The Rock is great. Dwayne Johnson is a really, really solid action star, and he's huge. He's huger now than ever before physically, but I feel like he's too good of an actor to play Hercules, you know?
That's a good point. I think you could make a case that Arnold Schwarzenegger also, though, has a lot of natural screen charisma. But one thing about this movie that I like is that, so you got Lou Ferrigno as Hercules, and he, I don't want to be mean, but he's not good. He's not acting really in this. And but he works in the role because I think somehow the worse the actor is, like the less screen charisma they have, the easier it is for them to come off like an underdog, even though they are 800 pounds of hard beef. So this guy, you know, he's just a wall of muscle. And he might look kind of like a bully beating up on the bad guys, except that he's kind of awkward and doesn't say his lines in a very natural way. And that gets you on his side somehow.
Yeah, you don't want him to be too confident or, you know, to have that confidence actually shine through in the performance. So, yeah, a lot of these, and I'll mention a few examples. Yeah, a lot of these movies come about with a non-actor muscle man that's, you know, pulled out of generally out of the bodybuilding world and is, you know, they strap the rockets to him. And sometimes they ascend, like Arnold is an example of that. Arnold, I guess, arguably gets better at acting as his career proceeds. But I was looking back at Michael Weldon's in the Psychotronic video and film guides, his write-up for the original Conan movie, and he kind of pans it. He's kind of like, it's another Dino film. It's it's all excess. It's it's non-actor Arnold Schwarzenegger punching a camel, and that's the only memorable moment in the film.
I mean, it is hard to forget the camels.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I disagree with Weldon on this, but he was looking at it like more or less around the time of the release too. So,
but another great thing about Hercules 1983 is that it doesn't require the hero to do much acting. I mean, Hercules doesn't really need to say a lot in this movie. Many of the scenes are him sort of being led around by other characters and instructed to do things, and then he does them.
Right. Usually brute strength, pretending to pick up a giant styrofoam boulder, but doing so in a way that really like shows off the muscles. And of course, as a director, you have to make sure that all those muscles are lit and oiled appropriately. So yeah. There's a real art to it.
What was the lotion budget for this movie?
Yeah. Now, if you're interested in a deeper dive into the history of muscle men movies, I have to recommend a book I was looking at. I didn't get a chance to pick it up and read it and do a deeper dive, but it's titled Descended from Hercules, Biopolitics and the Muscled Male Body on Screen by film scholar Robert A. Rushing. This looks like a really interesting read because I think it looks like it gets into a lot of the questions, not only the history of these movies, but also what does it mean when you take a body like this and you put it on the big screen and you make it be like the center of like truth and justice and all admirable qualities
in hypertrophy veritas.
Yeah. All right, so the Muscle Man movie eventually grows to include such films as Conan the Barbarian, Beastmaster, 300 would be a more recent Muscle Man movie. It's not centered so much around one Muscle Man, but like all Muscle Men, I guess. And you might well guess that, well, I guess all of this began with the mythic Hercules, right? I mean, he's been a popular figure, since antiquity. I mean, he was a Roman sensation. He's the equivalent of the Greek Heracles. But the interesting thing, and this is something that Rushing points out in his book, of course, is that Muscle Man movies begin actually with another figure, one that I'd never heard of till I started reading Michael Weldon's Psychotronic Film Guides, and that's Machiste. This is the original Italian cinema Muscle Man.
So a lot of the movies that I've always thought of as Hercules movies were actually machiste movies that were like retitled for American audiences with Hercules, or they'd give him some other muscle man name like Samson or something.
Right. Yeah. But machiste was the original. And apparently this just means it's kind of like machismo, you know, so it basically means the macho man. The film that apparently kicked all of this off was 1914's Cabiria. This was directed by Giovanni Pastrone. This is an epic set during the Second Punic War, based loosely on Gustave Flaubert's 1862 novel, Salammbô, which I've never read. I have a beautiful paperback copy of it on my shelf, but I've never actually read it.
Oh, interesting. So 1914, this goes way back.
This goes way back. This is legitimately one of the oldest and most popular figures, hero figures in cinematic history.
So This would make sense, though, that Muscle Man movies would go back to silent film times, or even this far back, but, you know, back to a time when, I mean, in the early days of film, a lot of what they were putting on film was not like dialogue driven narratives, but it was something that they thought would be interesting to look at.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this first film, though, Cabiria, was apparently a huge hit and was also highly stylish. You can look up stills of this or even footage of it, I believe, where you can see like these epic sets. It was a true sword and sandals epic that influenced a number of different filmmakers of the silent era. It's regarded as a silent era classic, but it also had this character who I don't even think is like the central character, but he's the huge muscular slave to the Roman spy Fulvius, who is on a spying mission to Carthage, I believe, in this film. And people really connected with this hero. Like, who is this big muscular guy?
He's the breakout character. He's the Boba Fett of this movie. Yeah, it's like, I want to know more about Machiste. I want the muscle guy.
So Machiste in this was played by Bartolomeo Pagano, who lived 1878 through 1947. He was a stevedore who was like discovered, like they see him and they're like, that guy, that is our Machiste. They haul him in and they cast him in the role. And he goes on to play Machiste almost exclusively for the rest of his career. All told, we're talking 30 films in which he plays Machiste out of a 32-film filmography over the course of 14 years, I believe.
So also, when this guy hits it big, no previous acting experience.
Right, right. No previous acting experience. And he just stuck with what works here.
I'm seeing a trend of like nearly a century now.
Yeah. So Pagano becomes
get those muscles in front of the camera.
So Pagano becomes an international film star. These Machiste films are a big hit, though they're often retitled in foreign markets. So the character becomes known, at least for subsequent films, as Hercules or Samson, you know, the biblical character, or the other biblical character that you might think of when you think of intense physical strength, Goliath.
That's a strange choice, because wasn't Goliath the villain of the story in the Bible? He was the Philistine soldier who David had to defeat. Even though David was smaller, he beat him by using his wits, by like exploiting a weakness.
It's only one of the most famous Old Testament stories, right? I mean, it always makes for great great illustrations and works of art, cinematic treatments. George Eastman played Goliath in one adaptation, we might remember.
Huh. But it didn't matter. Like, oh yeah, Goliath, he's our hero now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when a character is that muscular, I guess, and that strong, how can he be anything other than the hero of a picture? By the way, this also reminds me of how in so many of the El Santo movies were relabeled as Samson for foreign markets.
Hmm.
So just, I don't know, strong name. I don't know. They just want to get people in there. Now, the character Machiste would live on long after Pagano retired, appearing throughout the 60s and even the 70s. I think he shows up in some Jess Franco movies. But Machiste would basically just go on to fight various villains and monsters. He doesn't need to be part of a more epic plot. He's just here to do good and fight evil. He travels to the underworld. like, I think there's basically a Machiste Inferno movie. I don't know how much... Of Dante's original text is actually involved there in that, but he apparently goes to the Inferno, but he's often played in subsequent films by bodybuilders turned actors.
Now, as far as the Muscle Man movie timeline goes, I could be wrong about this, but I remember having an impression that these got huge in Italy and then subsequently around the world in like the 60s. Am I right about that?
Yes. And that's where we actually see the first Hercules movies, where it's not just a retitle of Hercules, but let's make a movie about Hercules. Mm-hmm. So you have an actor who had also played Machiste, Mark Forrest, take on the role in 1960's Revenge of Hercules, and this was an Italian film. And after that, more and more Herc movies get made, including, this one is attractive given all that we've talked about, 1964's Hercules, Samson, Machiste, and Ursus, the Invincibles. So you get like four different strongmen all teaming up to battle evil in that one. And this was 64.
It was the Expendables of 1964.
Yeah. And of course, from then on, we have various actors, generally, like very, very often, bodybuilders turned actors playing the role. Alan Steele, Steve Reeves, I've already mentioned Mark Forrest, and various others. You know, Brian Thompson would go on to, would play him at least once. This is, of course, the big muscular dude who was one of the punks in Terminator and also played Shao Kahn in the second Mortal Kombat movie.
One was good.
you get Kevin Sorbo, of course, playing him on screen. You get The Rock taking a shot at it. And also, it should be noted, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yeah. So this was an interesting coincidence we were pointing out. So in this movie, Hercules is played by Lou Ferrigno. And I'm right in saying this is his first movie. This was Lou Ferrigno's first feature film.
I believe so. Yes. He had done Hulk already. So he'd done Hulk and various TV appearances, but this was the rocket that was going to propel Lou Ferrigno into the cinematic stratosphere.
And also Arnold Schwarzenegger's first screen role was playing Hercules in a 1970 movie called Hercules in New York, which I have seen, but I remember almost nothing about except that it was almost unwatchably boring.
Did it have Robert Englund in it? Am I remembering that correctly? What? Is Robert Englund in that?
If so, I've forgotten about that. I watched this in college, and I remember it being like hard to hear what anybody was saying in it. Mm. But the premise is Arnold Schwarzenegger is a muscle guy, and he's Hercules, and the gods send him down to New York for some reason. So he's just running around in modern New York. Fish out of water, fish out of time.
Ah, shenanigans ensue, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right, well, shall we go ahead and hear the trailer for Hercules 1983?
Hit it.
From the depths of space comes the strongest man on Earth in the Super Adventure Odyssey. Hercules. The incredible Lou Ferrigno is Hercules. In a battle with unearthly creatures, Hercules, the superhuman hero, with the strength of an army. Hercules facing love and the bewitching forces of evil. The incredible Lou Ferrigno is Hercules. A Golan Globus production from the Canon Group.
This is a pretty good trailer, I have to admit.
I don't think I actually watched it, so I don't know what you just heard.
Well, take my word for it. This one is Zeus approved.
Well, if it's the Zeus in this movie, I don't know if it's going to be that hard to get approved, because this is a kind of groovy, hands-off Zeus who may be about to take a nap.
Yeah, this is a snoozer of a Zeus.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth.
So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, let's start at the top with this one. The writer-director on this one is Luigi Cozzi. Writer and director, born 1947, still making films today. Italian director, probably best known for this film and also its sequel, as well as his frequent work with Dario Argento.
I did not know this movie had a sequel. Is Lou Ferrigno also in it?
Yes. And I was reading like mixed accounts on whether he was like sort of tricked into doing a sequel. Like they were filming stuff for another film and they're like, let's make it a sequel. I'm not sure.
I could imagine them just repurposing his shots from this movie and making a sequel around them, because a lot of the scenes with Lou Ferrigno in this movie primarily feature Lou Ferrigno doing reaction shots rather than talking. So it's another character talking and then him just making a blank face into the camera.
Yeah.
So I'm saying you could use that with pretty much anything.
Yeah, absolutely. He looks at something, he reacts, he runs down a tunnel, and then he lifts something. Let's talk a little bit more about Cozzi here. His first film was a 1969 low-budget adaptation of Frederick Pohl's novella, The Tunnel Under the World, which apparently got Dario Argento's attention. And he subsequently worked with Argento on 1971's Four Flies on Grey Velvet, earning a story credit. He also has a story credit on Argento's 1973 action comedy, The 5 Days. He goes on to direct his own giallo film with 1975's The Killer Must Kill Again. But then from there, he really goes on to cement his place in cinematic history, writing and directing such epic Italian B-movies as, of course, this, but also 1979's Star Crash and 1980's Contamination.
Oh, I did not make the connection to Star Crash, but that makes so much sense. This movie has extremely powerful Star Crash flavor. Just waves of Star Crash aroma wafting off of it. Even in the scenes where they talk about rays, I was repeatedly reminded of Star Crash. There were at least like five dialogue moments that were akin to, nothing can stop these deadly rays. These deadly rays will be your death.
Yeah, there's a lot of shared DNA between this film and Star Crash. Now, Coetzee also worked in various other roles on other Argento projects. So he seems to be a frequent collaborator and helper to Argento. But he was also second assistant director on the notorious Klaus Kinski Nosferatu sequel. So this is the sort of unofficial sequel to Werner Herzog's Nosferatu movie titled Vampire in Venice. This is the one where basically Kinski reportedly showed up. He was supposed to have had his head shaved to play Nosferatu, and he says, basically, no, I'm not shaving my head, and also, I am directing this film now. I've never seen it, but it has something of a reputation.
Well, I bet that would have an aroma all of its own, a somewhat different one, yeah.
All right, the star of this film is, of course, as we've mentioned, Lou Ferrigno, born 1957, former professional bodybuilder, pumping iron contemporary of Arnold Schwarzenegger, seen here at what feels like just peak condition and just peak mass.
He is voluminous in this movie. He is just an absolute skyscraper of meat.
Yes. Like I said, they do a lot of showing off of his physique. And you know, you hear jokes about people skipping leg day. Ferrigno did not skip leg day. He has just legs, just muscular tree trunks.
I feel like this movie has a lot of scenes of close-ups of those, I guess somebody's got big muscles and low body fat and their veins are just poking out through the skin while they're flexing. There's a lot of that.
Absolutely. Now, Ferrigno, again, is probably best known to many as the original green-skinned Hulk from TV's The Incredible Hulk, which began as a two-hour pilot in 1977 and ran five seasons, 80 episodes, till 1982, and was then followed by three TV films, one of which featured Thor, and another one had the character Kingpin in it, played by John Rhys-Davies. Ferrigno played the Hulk in all of those as well. He ultimately didn't achieve the same level of fame as Arnold, but he still played Hercules in this film and its sequel, and he also played Sinbad in Enzo G. Castellari's 1989 Sinbad of the Seven Seas. So there we get a double dipping of the mythic there.
Oh, wow. I've never seen that one, and that's funny because I have a deep appreciation for the in many ways quite bad, but in other ways wonderful Ray Harryhausen Sinbad movies, which have some great stop motion monsters in them. I did not know that Ferrigno was in any later Sinbad adaptations.
Yeah, definitely a later Sinbad, not the classic Harryhausen.
I can only imagine, but it seems like it'd probably be bad.
Now, every hero needs a villain, and so we have one in this film. And if you're going to choose a villain out of the catalog of Greek mythology, I feel like this is a good choice. They decided to go with King Minos.
Oh, yes, and he makes a wonderful villain in this movie, though mostly what he does is apparently stand around on the moon talking about which robots will next be sent to kill Hercules.
Yes, and explaining the plot a little, explaining his plans, and sometimes just asking that the evil robots that are going to be sent down be made bigger just so he can look at them.
Oh, yeah, can you make it a little bit bigger?
he's a bit more of a project manager. In many ways, but anyway, fun villain played by the actor William Berger, who lived 1928 through 1993, Austrian-American actor who pops up in a lot of spaghetti westerns and just plays a lot of villains in general in Euro cinema. He appears in the films of such directors as Jess Franco, Enzo G. Castellari, Mario Bava, Lamberto Bava, and also Ron O'Neill. So he's great in this as the evil King Minos. He has one of these mustacheless beards that looks particularly evil on his face for some reason.
Mm-hmm. It could, in another context, look rather Mennonite, but no, in his context, it does look like a beard of ill intent.
Yes. All right, and then playing the daughter of King Minos, we have the character Adriana, played by Sybil Danning, who is another Austrian-American actor of note, born 1952. She was an actor and model, best known for a whole string of B-movies in the 70s and 80s. Some of her probably most famous roles include Roger Corman's Battle Beyond the Stars from 1980. She's also in Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf from 1985. But she appears like randomly in just films you wouldn't expect her to. Like she's pops up in the Musketeer films from the 70s, the ones that you know had like Michael York and Oliver Reed and Christopher Lee in them.
So she's a villain in this. Mostly she sort of walks around scheming and whispering in people's ears to get them to do bad things. I don't know if this is true. I read that in an earlier version of the script, she was maybe going to be Hercules' love interest, but like that she and Lou Ferrigno did not get along and the script was rewritten so that she was a villain. Did you read that?
I didn't read that. I had read that an early version of the script was more provocative and that Lou Ferrigno especially was like, nope, I'm not filming this. It needs to be cleaner. And so they made what is it essentially a G-rated film. Like one of the reasons I ended up putting this on was that it was a long weekend. There was some snowy weather, and I was like, I need something that I can play with the family moving around the house, and this looked like a good selection.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was rated PG. It's in some areas, I think they're pushing it.
Well, but, in some areas, they're really pushing these outfits.
Yeah,
these outfits are pushed to the limits by the various male and female actors wearing them.
Yes. Like at one point, it seems like they went out of their way to put like when Lou Ferrigno is first birthed out of the cosmos and they show him floating in space in his ideal form. It looks like they went out of their way to match the color of his Speedo to his skin tone so that it was exactly the same.
Yeah. I have to say another thing about Lou Ferrigno in this is that he pretty much has the physique of one of the old Masters of the Universe He-Man toys. Mm-hmm. So I remember catching parts of this on like TBS or TNT back when I was a kid. And this just felt natural because I'm like, well, yes, that is there it is. That is the body of a He-Man action figure. I have a whole bunch of these in a box. So it makes sense that this is our hero.
But wait, I have a note about Sybil Danning's character.
Okay.
Okay. So this character's name is all over the place. When I watched the movie, I watched it on HBO Max. And yep. So the character that Sybil Danning is playing, and this corresponds to the actual mythology, is Ariadne or Ariadna. Mm-hmm. That's usually spelled A-R-I-A-D-N-E. Then in the movie, it seemed like the characters were saying her name out loud as Ariana, like it would be A-R-I-N-A. And then in the subtitles and some text for promoting the movie, her name is Adriana or A-D-R-I-A-N-A. So there's like three different versions of what her name is, and the movie itself doesn't seem to agree. I don't know. Maybe that's nitpicking, but
well, not the first or last time we've encountered pronunciations being all over the place for a character.
Well, and spellings, but never mm-hmm. mind.
All right, let's move on to some of the supporting characters here. We have, of course, the god Zeus pops up frequently in this, played in this film by Claudio Casanelli, who lived 1938 through 1985. You might remember him from our discussion of the post-apocalyptic film Hands of Steel. He is the actor who played one of the villains in that film that died in a tragic helicopter crash during the filming of Hands of Steel. Now, he was frequently popped up in various Italian films, often playing, I think, kind of villains here and there. Now, when you cast an actor as Zeus, I mean, that's a big acting ask. I mean, to my mind, I instantly think of Laurence Olivier playing Zeus in Clash of the Titans, which came out a few years before this, and I think definitely influenced this film in some ways that we'll discuss. I think of Liam Neeson's playing Zeus in the remakes of the Clash of the Titans films. You know, so there's a grandiose presence that needs to be there to be Zeus. And you think about like who Zeus is in the myths, like he's a powerful and dangerous figure. Like you don't want to get on the bad side of Zeus. The Zeus in this film is a different experience.
Yes, yes, totally. You want that combination of like authoritative and irresponsible.
Yeah.
Somebody who is simultaneously like when he talks, everybody turns and listens and people are afraid of him, but also he's unpredictable, undependable, and dangerous.
Right. In this, he's more a little sleepy.
Yeah. Well, but also the actor who plays him, Once I noticed this, I couldn't unsee it, and he just looked like him in every single shot. He looks like Jon Stewart.
Yes,
John of the Daily Show. He looks like Jon Stewart in a Santa Claus wig and beard.
Yes, and I didn't put this together till you mentioned it. You sent me this picture, and I'm like, oh my god, he does. And he looks like he's doing that sort of Jon Stewart sort of shock confusion face that he often pulls in bits. So yes. It totally looks like a Jon Stewart bit.
It looks like it's like Jon Stewart playing a satirical take on Zeus, so a befuddled Zeus.
Right. Let's see. Who else do we have in this? We have King Aegeus, played by Brad Harris. Harris lived 33 through 2017. American bodybuilder turned actor, turned European acting mainstay. He played a lot of strong men in his career, including Goliath and Samson. So this kind of feels like a wink to the muscle man cinema fans of the day.
Okay.
Then we have an Israeli actor by the name of Yehuda Efrani, who plays the character Dorkon, who is, I believe, the advisor to this king. He's an Israeli actor, again, who appeared in 1989's Phantom of the Opera, starring Robert Englund. This is the Nightmare on Elm Street-inspired Phantom of the Opera film. He pops up in The Delta Force, American Ninja 3, and in the film The Omega Code.
Oh, The Omega Code. That's a Christian apocalypse movie, one of my favorite genres.
Yeah, starring Michael York, I think, was the villain in that, right?
He was. He plays the Antichrist. And it also has Michael Ironside as a henchman of the Antichrist. Casper Van Dien as like a self-help author who... in the end, he gets converted and becomes a good guy. Let's see, who else is in it? I think those are all the main actors. Oh, Catherine Oxenberg is in it. Mm. She was in like Lair of the White Worm and stuff.
All right. Now we have the character Cassiopeia is essentially the damsel in distress in this film. And she is played by Ingrid Anderson, born 1960, American actor making her film debut here. She mostly did television after this. Another important female character in this is Circe. Circe is, of course, the witch, the sorceress. And in this, she is played by Mirella D'Angelo, born 1956, Italian actor whose credits also include Caligula and Tenebrae.
Oh, she's actually pretty great in this, especially because when we first meet her, she's in she's in crone form.
Yeah.
And then she drinks Hercules's blood. Am I right about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She cuts him and drinks his blood so she can regain her youth and strength and magic powers. And then there's a long middle section of the movie where it's just Circe bossing Hercules around, and it's great. He's just following her around doing everything she tells him to do. She's like, oh, I need you to reach inside this glowing egg, and he's like, okay. Oh, it burned my hand. And she's like, you must reach.
He's like, no, it's freezing my hand. It's a great sequence.
Your hand's in there again.
Yeah, so Circe's great in this, and is definitely one of the many characters who's again wearing their outfit to the absolute limit.
Oh my god, the tassels on her outfit are hilarious. Mm-hmm.
All right, another character. So we mentioned King Minos. Now we have Minos, and we have Minos's daughter, and yet we have no maze or labyrinth in this film, and we have no Minotaur. So don't get excited about the prospect of either of those standard features of a King Minos story popping up. But we do have the character who is, of course, credited in the various myths as creating the labyrinth and creating various other works of artistry and technical craftsmanship in the mythological canon, and that is the character Daedalus.
Now, in this movie, Daedalus is not a human craftsman. She is like a figure who is birthed out of the chaos of the universe and then takes form and wears this strange costume that has these big ears and talks about how she hates magic and hates the gods and only loves science.
Right, yes. And they're plotting, basically plotting the destruction of the gods via science. They're talking about how much better than the god science is. It's pretty fabulous. This is where the robots come into play. They are the automatons of Daedalus here.
Yeah, she makes the robots that Minos greedily begs her to send against Hercules.
Yes. So in this film, Daedalus is played by Eva Robbins, a transgender Italian actress, model, and activist who appeared in Dario Argento's Tenebrae as Woman on the Beach. She played the famed inventor of Greek mythology in both of the Coetzee Hercules movies. So she does pop up in the sequel. Ooh. And I should mention, dressed in an just absolutely bonkers costume here that feels like part comic book villain from space and also part Christmas tree ornament.
Yeah, I was trying to. Her helmet,
yes.
Is, I don't know how to. It's a little bit Planet of the Vampires, but spray painted gold, and then with these big ears popping off of it. It reminded me a little bit of some of the diamond shaped ear ornaments popping off of. I think I remember from the acrobats in the Star Wars Holiday Special that pop up in the hologram.
Yeah, that's a fair comparison. Robbins continued to act in European indie films after this, sometimes appearing alongside such actors as Charlotte Rampling. So she apparently wanted to have quite an interesting career.
Well, I loved every one of her scenes in this movie. The Minos Daedalus scenes are highlights of the film.
Yes. Now this is a character who sadly doesn't really do much. But we have this character show up at one point to challenge Hercules by the name of King Zenodama. And this character is played by Big Bobby Rhodes, born 1947.
From Demons.
Yes, black Italian actor who pops up in a number of Italian action and B-movies. Probably best known, for playing Tony the Pimp and Hank the Gym Instructor in Lamberto Bava's Demons and Demons 2. But he can also be found in The Island of the Fishmen, a.k.a. Screamers. He was in Sergio Martino's The Great Alligator, which features a story credit by George Eastman. And he also did stunts. He's credited with underwater stunts on the 1989 underwater monster movie Leviathan. So he's great, but he's kind of wasted in this film.
Oh, well, yeah, he plays a small role. He plays like the king who Hercules and Circe need something from him, and in order to get it, Hercules has to grow huge and then like push apart the Strait of Gibraltar, the pillars of Hercules.
Yeah, and basically Bobby Rhodes' character just watches on from a litter. And it doesn't really do anything but just act amazed at this. I thought they were going to fight or something. I was getting excited. Oh.
Well, the litter that he's being carried in, though, is a mammoth skeleton. That was pretty
that's
cool.
Right.
So he's like within the ribs of a mammoth.
The mammoth skeleton made me think of Meow Wolf in Santa Fe. And I have to say that several of the sets in this movie just feel like Meow Wolf. Like I'm just straight up back in Meow Wolf, except there are various Greek gods standing around. All right, one more credit on this before we move on to the plot, and that is, of course, coming back to the music here. The music is by Pino Donaggio, born 1941. The music here is rather traditional for the most part, but Pino is a rather big name, noted for working with such directors as Joe Dante, Lucio Fulci, Terence Hill, Charles Band, and probably most famously, Brian De Palma. He worked with De Palma on 8 different films, Carrie, Home Movies, Dressed to Kill, Blowout, Body Double, Raising Cain, Snake Eyes, Passion, and Domino.
Wow. I honestly got to say, I don't remember much about the music in the movie. It didn't really strike me one way or another.
I mean, it's one of those scores that I feel like it did the job. It did exactly what it needed to do. It doesn't stand out. It certainly doesn't overshadow anything going on with Ferrigno's muscles on the screen. So it's in a perfect supporting role.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, well, let's dive into the plot of this baby.
All right, well, I think this is one where we're not going to do the whole story beat by beat, but focus on some sections that were interesting to us. And I do want to start right at the beginning because I love the way this movie begins. I love a movie that where the prologue goes all the way back to the beginning of the universe, or actually in this case, before the beginning of the universe, because it starts off just by showing you slow motion fireworks exploding. And then it says, in the beginning, before creation, there was darkness. And then we learn that from the primordial explosion emerged the fire of chaos. And then the chaos merged with the darkness. And from this union were born the elements. Rob, do you have a notepad ready to record what the elements are?
Okay, let's go.
There's four of them. Okay, the elements are night, day, matter, and air.
Okay.
Oh, and I like that when it's telling us this, so the chaos merged with the darkness, there is like a It's just this long series of sort of vaguely cosmic looking special effects shots. And this one is something that's on fire, bathed in red light, moving toward the camera.
Yeah. Yeah. We're in just total cosmic mode for several minutes here. There are no humans. There's just space stuff going on.
Right. Okay. So we got the four elements, night, day, matter, and air. And then after this, we find out that out of the misty radiance of the cosmos, there came forth a jar, golden and glittering, Pandora's jar. But then it shows us the jar and it looks like a spaceship. It's got different, like multicolored windows.
Yeah, it's pretty, like it's as close to looking like a spaceship as it could be without just blatantly being a space. Like I think they manage it rather nicely. Like they're not going too far with the sci-fi, but they're going right up to the line.
Uh-huh. We find out it is filled with the essences, both good and evil, of life itself. And then we see the jar explode. It's clearly, this is one of the parts I talked about where like they kind of don't even care with the special effects where, so it explodes and then you just see a couple of parts of it don't fly off and fall down. They're like hanging from threads. But then we learn that from the fragments of the jar, remember this was the jar, Pandora's jar that contained all of the essence of life, both good and evil. And from the fragments of that jar, it says that the planets and the solar system were formed. And then you see the jar fragments zooming through space like the fighter ships on Battlestar Galactica. And so it starts explaining planets to us. It's like, here are some of the planets. It tells us about Saturn, the world of mystic rings. And then it says other fragments became the flaming energies that gave shape to Mercury. Yet another fragment gave birth to the Colossus, Jupiter, the Titan of the skies. Any Greek mythology nerds want to pick a bone with that one? I'll leave it there. But then it goes on. So we're getting closer to Earth. It says the worlds of the universe were created along with the moons that accompany them and then Earth. And then it says, and on Earth there was life everywhere. And then we get like a zoom in shot to what looks like a satellite photo of one of the shores of Michigan or something. But then finally, we need some beings to populate these worlds, right? So it says that the first beings that the creation brought forth were not men. They were of the supreme essence and became gods. They claimed the moon as their home. So in this version of Greek mythology, the gods were the first creation, not the Titans. So it doesn't do the multiple generations. They were the first creation and they live on the moon.
Yeah. There's no Mount Olympus. It's the moon instead. Instead of this planet that's filled with life, they're going to live on this just desolate moonscape.
And what do the gods do there on the moon? Well, there are only three of them. There's Zeus, Hera, and Athena. And they sit there on the moon, and it says they decide the ultimate fate of mankind and of all that lived.
Yeah, they're simplifying the pantheon somewhat here.
Right. And so the thing about the gods in this movie is that they are severely on drugs. When we get zoom-ins of all three of the gods, I would say especially Hera and Athena, but all three of them really seem to be in a kind of potent pharmaceutical realm. Like their pupils are a mile wide.
Right. And they don't have a lot of emotion in what they're saying and what they're doing. They don't really have the characterizations that you're more accustomed to with, say, Zeus and then also Athena are just not going to be found here.
I would say the one that actually feels the most out of character of all three of them is Athena. Athena, I feel like, should be a sharp and powerful presence. She is, there's so much that Athena is. Athena is wisdom. Athena is warfare. Athena is all these things. In this movie, she is zonked. She's just kind of airily delivering lines as if I'm not even sure if she's aware whether anybody is listening or not.
And really, these whole sequences kind of feel like sportscaster sequences. Like, let's go back and hear the commentary. And here they are just sort of very, very detached, talking about a game happening, somewhere else across the city.
That's right. So they're in this set that has these weird pillars coming up off the surface of the moon. And then Zeus says, okay, Pandora's jar has been broken. The forces of evil have been let loose. The world of mortal men is facing its hour of decision. It will go down to destruction or else it will survive. And then Hera says, of course, Hera is always making kind of a nasty face. I mean, Hera is often the villain of these stories. Certainly, she's the enemy of Hercules. That is true to the myth, I think. But Hera says, this is their moment of trial. They have to show themselves worthy of everything we gods have given them. But it hasn't made clear that they've given them anything. But anyway, so finally Athena comments, she's like, but evil is dark and strong. It may be that the scales of fate are not equally balanced. So Zeus takes all this into consideration and he decides that there needs to be a way to equalize both sides of the struggle. It's not entire. I think this means the sides of the struggle are on one side, it's humans, and on the other side, it's the destruction of humans. Mm-hmm. So he's like, okay, we need to make this fair. So he asks Athena, like, how can we make it fair? How can we do it?
Yeah. And Zeus, again, known for his fairness.
Right. And so Athena has an amazing idea. She says, if you don't want to increase the powers of all men, why don't you increase those of one so that he may fight for all the others?
What a weird capitalist approach to orchestrating the affairs of men.
But Zeus, his reaction is he's clearly enthralled by this idea. It's like, if you ever seen when somebody mentioned, you know, somebody's really hungry and then somebody else suggests a delicious food they could eat and their eyes sort of like go off somewhere, like they're just imagining it. That's the way Zeus reacts. He's really grooving with it. He goes, a man who is stronger and more intelligent than all other men, just gazing at his lap. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they decide, yeah, that's what we'll do. We'll get a hero. And they say it'll be a hero with the body forged in the furnace of 1,000 suns, a body capable of undergoing every labor, every pain, practically invincible, made from the purest of all energies, light.
I like how he kind of totally spaces on the idea of the superior intellect and just focuses on the body.
Right.
Which is, again, what you want in a Hercules movie.
Right. So they start off as saying that this will be a man who is stronger and more intelligent than all other men. This is not a comment about Lou Ferrigno. This is like in the script, there's really not much to indicate that this Hercules is even of average intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's just part of it. I mean, yeah, Hercules, in the myths, you do have more of a, like, there's the cunning of Hercules. But we don't really see the cunning of Hercules in this film. It is the brute strength of Hercules. And when cunning things need to be done, well, that's where Circe or some other character is going to apply some cunning thought.
Like, multiple of the labors of Hercules involve not brute strength, but him coming up with, like, an outside-the-box solution to a problem.
They do actually reflect one of the cunning moments of Hercules in this. But
that's true. The cleaning of the stables, yeah.
Yeah, the Aegean stables, which, of course, is this whole sequence in the – It's fascinating because I watched the film and I had to quiz my wife and son. I said, you guys know the trials of Hercules. Guess which one they did in this film. And I think I quizzed you the same way. Like, which is the last one you would choose for a cinematic portrayal? You know, it doesn't feature a monster. It just features the cleaning of some just awful poop-filled stables.
Yeah.
That's the one that they choose. Though it's a great sequence as well, because the stable, like everything in this film, the stables look like they are on another planet. Like every location in this film feels like a different cosmic location. The stables look like horses, like these twin horses, and he diverts a whole river to flood it. It's a great scene.
It is, yeah. But that comes much later. We're still at the phase here where they're talking about sending this being made of light to Earth, and then it shows him. So it like fades in on Hercules wearing a Speedo, posing, flexing his muscles amidst the stars.
Yes. Greased and lit from above.
And I guess the problem is they can't send him to Earth like this. I don't know why they can't, but they just can't. You know, he can't arrive at Earth as an adult being made of light. Instead, I think the deal is they have to slot his Herc soul, which is made of light, into the body of a mortal baby. Yeah. But then that makes me wonder, wait, what happened to the baby's original soul?
I mean, maybe there was no original soul. Like, this one was already slotted for this baby, okay. Right?
They birthed a soulless baby in preparation for inserting the Hercules soul, the muscle soul made of light from the stars into the baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, Lou Ferrigno, he goes down, he possesses a baby. This baby is, this part I think is sort of according to the myth, is the child of Amphitryon and Alcmene. And this is at the city of Thebes. It tells us this is the city of Thebes in the Bronze Age, 4,000 years from this moment. But then I'm like, wait, is Thebes also on the moon? Because they show Thebes, yeah, and it looks like it's in space. It's this stone city with these big walls. I mean, it looks kind of like a cross between a medieval castle and like Chatalhoyuk, but it's in space with like comets zipping around.
Oh yeah, it's like that with every location, isn't it? Like later on, we go to Atlantis, and it's like green. It looks like another planet. And then I was asking myself, is this supposed to be another planet? And then they show the sky, and it has like three moons or something. You
know? Uh huh. Yeah.
And they're traveling through space at various times to get from one location to the other. So very cosmic without characters actually coming out and referring to these as different planetary locations.
Yeah. I did not know what to make of that, but you know what? I enjoyed looking at it. So, okay. But immediately Hera is trying to kill this baby because, you know, that's what Hera does. She doesn't like Hercules and she wants to destroy him. So she sets events in motion to lead to the death of baby Hercules. And then we get an escape in infancy narrative, you know, like I guess this is there in some of the original Hercules myths, but it's also like, you know, the stories of Moses or Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, where like there's a chosen baby and then like the forces are aligned against him and he has to be secreted away. Mm-hmm. So in this case, in Thebes, there's a usurper king who comes in and he kills Hercules' parents and he's trying to kill Hercules. He's being urged on by one of the recurring villains of the movie, played by Sybil Danning, who is she plays the daughter of the wicked King Minos of Thera, who we'll get to in just a minute. But so there's like a rebellion against the king's forces, and the narrator comes in, I think, and says like, and the wicked rebels turned Thebes into a war zone. And it just shows, you know, fire and a bunch of people going, ah. Meanwhile, I should also say, like, when we see the soldiers and stuff in these scenes, it is just a feast of weird fake gold armor and cod pieces.
Yep.
Oh, and there's also a thing. This actually turns out to be important later. I mean, we're not going to try to explain every in and out of the plot, but there is an important theft at the beginning where like a thief sneaks into a temple and steals a sacred sword, this kind of sword in the stone. He pulls it out of its resting place. He kills a couple of guards with some hilarious bow and arrow action.
Right. And then that sword is basically never mentioned again for the rest of the film till we get to the very end, and then it becomes extremely important and is reestablished.
Yeah. And so little Hercules gets taken away by a nursemaid to protect him from the evil rebels. And she puts him on a river, puts him on a boat and sets it down a river. And then Hera tries to kill him multiple ways. I think at one point he's going over a waterfall, but then Zeus, in this hilarious special effect, reaches out and catches the boat from the waterfall. And you see this giant pale hand reaching out from the water that gets the boat and then pulls him to the moon, where he's like this tiny little thing in his hand, and it shows Zeus looking at the boat. He's like, oh, and then he puts him back in the river. Hera's like, you can't do that. That's cheating. You have to put him back in the river. And then he does, but he puts him downstream of the waterfall. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you didn't tell me which part of the river to put him in.
Sneaky Zeus.
But then also Hera tries to send a couple of snakes to kill Hercules, and baby Herc just strangles him.
Oh yeah, it's a great sequence because they're super fake monster snakes, and this baby is not a good actor. It's just not very convincing at all. So it makes for a hilarious sequence.
One thing I wanted to know, so of course Hercules gets rescued by a nice old couple, and they take him in and raise him, and you know, they're very sweet. They're sweet pastoralists, and we get a montage of him growing up and growing stronger. And how do you think, so Conan the Barbarian came out in 1982, this movie came out in 1983. How do you think they're going to show young Hercules growing and getting stronger?
Oh, you got to strap him to that millstone.
That's right. So they have a montage of him turning a millstone.
The really fun thing, the fun thing about this, though, I was reading, is that there is a millstone scene, I think, in the first Machiste movie. So I believe John Milius may have actually been referencing the history of Muscle Man movies by including that in Conan the Barbarian.
Well, that would make sense. Okay, I'm back on board now. Every movie should have it then. It's just that they're all calling back to the original.
How else are you going to know that he's strong and that time is passing? Like, this is the logical way to do it.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Picture this, it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Once he grows up, he is, of course, Lou Ferrigno then, and we get to see him being very strong, you know, chopping wood, pulling trees up out of the ground with his arms. And one of the great scenes, once he's finally an adult, is the bear scene. Rob, could you describe the bear scene?
So it is your basic bear wrestling scene, and I think it possibly reuses some bear footage from another movie. I forget which one. But you know, it's Hercules versus a bear. You know who's going to win. It's going to be Hercules. But what do you expect to happen when Hercules defeats the bear? You think he might just, you know, either he whips the bear and says, all right, go back to the wild, you, or, you know, or puts a sleeper hold on it and just, you know, just puts it to sleep and walks off. No, that's not good enough. That's not epic enough for this Hercules.
Well, first of all, also, it intercuts between stock footage of a real bear and then one of the worst bear suits I've ever seen in film. Like, unbelievable. It's worse than the Wicker Man remake bear suit.
I didn't even notice that. I mean, I don't know. I didn't think too long and hard about it being a fake bear.
Well, I mean, it's a guy wearing a bunch of carpet samples, basically. But he defeats the bear. Oh, and the bear kills his father, the man who raised him. Yeah. So he kills that guy. That guy's laying dead on the ground, and Hercules is like, "Oh, you bear!" And then he grabs him and he throws him into space.
Yes, it's a great sequence because it's just as goofy as it sounds.
But of course, the bear thrown into space by Hercules, you know, here's your mythic connection, thrown up into space by Hercules and becomes the constellation Ursa, the bear in the sky.
Mm-hmm. The first of many constellations, right?
Right, right. Well, yeah, actually, because after this, Athena and Hera like taunt each other. Athena's like, haha, all your heroes are going. I guess this means Hera sent the bear. Mm-hmm. She's like, all your heroes are going to end up getting thrown into space. Hera's like, don't worry, I have many other people waiting to fight for evil. And here's the part where we get into one of my favorite things in the movie. My favorite recurring characters, Minos and Daedalus.
Yes.
Now, I can't remember what we already said about where Minos is, where they are in this scene. I don't know how to even begin to describe where they are, or what is happening, but it looks like Minos is like in space on the moon or on some other planet, mm-hmm. standing among a bunch of rocks on top of a giant stone head that has a mustache and is glowing from the inside.
Yeah, it's bonkers. I have no idea where they're supposed to be.
I think they're in space somewhere, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Which is weird because we get the impression that he's based on Earth, right? Like, what's he do?
When
is
the island of Thera, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know if he's come out here to meet Daedalus, like you have to meet Daedalus halfway or what?
I really don't know.
But this is where they meet and scheme.
Right, so Minos calls out. Minos is like, Daedalus, embodiment of knowledge, reason, and curiosity, great genius of invention, master of science. I, King Minos of Thera, call on you to step into time and space. That's great. Materialize out of chaos. So he tries that, looks around, no Daedalus. So then he tries again and he goes, Daedalus! And then she finally does appear. Mm-hmm. Is she wearing a cellophane cape?
Yeah, it does have some clear. Yeah, it looks cellophane. And then there's like this neck guard that is like clear plastic. It's a lot, this costume.
Well, there's immediately conflict between them because Daedalus is afraid that Minos wants her to serve the gods, but she hates the gods, so nothing to do with them. And she's like, one day, Minos, you will have to choose between the gods and science. And he says, you know me, I'm dedicated to science. I do not believe in the gods, but doing them a little favor can't hurt, can it? And so he's going to be working for Hera because she's bad. And this is setting up one of the major themes of the movie, which is truly deeply bizarre. It makes no sense whatsoever in the context of this story, and it makes no sense on its own terms, but it's this science versus magic theme. I think this is basically a dynamic like we saw in The Thing from Another World. It's like a jocks versus nerds movie, with the jocks representing magic and goodness and the nerds representing science and evil.
Yeah, so it's like it seems like in some respects it's a weirdly anti-science movie. It's just like God's rule, science rules kind of a thing.
Well, and it's not an argument over like whether science is good or not. It was it's like science of course is evil, and that is why we support it, because we like evil.
Yeah. It is interesting how, like, I feel like a less imaginative film might have gone with this and been like, okay, we'll have Daedalus be in here. And, you know, Daedalus will be just kind of like a mad scientist, you know, a well-established trope, clearly, by this point in cinema. Yet they didn't go in that direction at all. Instead, we have this Daedalus agent embodiment of chaos who doesn't even live in our normal space-time, kind of appearing to Minos. Like an ambassador of another world.
Yeah, very strange. Step into time and space. But anyway, Daedalus is eventually like, okay, I've already stepped into time and space. We can kill Lou Ferrigno. That is doable. And she says, this is my solution to Hercules. And then she pops up three like erector set toys.
Yeah, these erector sets are a good reference. They're these very, very interesting looking small automatons. Mm-hmm. There's a dragon-looking creature, there's a sort of bug-looking creature, and there's a kind of a centaur-looking creature. And they're strange-looking. There's a definite direction here in the way they decided to portray these. I wonder to what extent they were clearly influenced by Clash of the Titans, which had come out, you know, years before, that had some, you know, had like the mechanical owl in it. That
right.
Is
yes.
It's a real hoot. Certainly one of the fun parts of that film. And they're like, well, we one mechanical owl, we can have three mechanical villains, and maybe it'll simplify the whole stop motion monster thing. Like, we're not going to really be able to bring the full Harryhausen game to this film. So maybe we can do something that is a little less fleshy, but also cool to look at.
Right. So Minos, but he reacts by being, he's like, such a small solution to such a big problem. And then he looks sadly directly into the camera. but Daedalus is like, Minos, my dear, size, like time and space, is relative. And then he realizes relative to atmospheric conditions, right? And on hitting Earth's atmosphere, it will grow. Big, huge, immense, terrifying. Is he programmed to destroy Hercules? They talk to these little mechanical toys. They talk about the colossal exterminator that you really are. So they send a giant robot bee to kill Hercules. And then Hercules defeats it by poking it with a stick. To be fair, he pokes it very hard and multiple times. But he does defeat the giant robot by poking it with a stick. Oh, and at this point, his father's been killed by a bear. His mother is killed by a giant bee robot during the giant bee robot attack, and Hercules is just bereft. So he must strike out on his own to answer the riddle of his life. And there's a great moment where he looks off in the distance and says, why am I stronger than other men? here he goes on to a series of adventures and labors that will, of course, end with him facing the evil King Minos and his wicked daughter, Sybil Danning, to kill science once and for all and save the world. And along the way, there are all kinds of weird adventures and encounters. Again, we're not going to hit all the points on there, but Rob, are there any ones that you want to mention in particular? Maybe it would be good to start with the contest of strength in Tyre. What do you think?
Oh, that's a great sequence, because there's he wrestles like a dozen men who have a log.
Yes.
He battles like multiple swordsmen, I think. And then he goes up against two chariots with blades on the like spokes of the wheels.
Yeah.
And this was a sequence. I remember seeing this on TV for sure. I don't think I'd ever seen this film in its entirety before, but I remember this part because the chariots make two swipes at him. The first time they come at him, we go to a side view and he Super Mario jumps over them. And then when they come back to get him the second time, he just stands there and the blades break against the brutal beef of his legs. Like he's just so muscular that blades cannot cut him. And then he like grabs the chariots and pulls back, defeats four horses with his awesome strength.
Right. The most important thing about a warrior is that he have indestructible shins. That's what we learn from this. And of course, Hercules wins the contest. He is the greatest warrior competing in Tyre. And so the whole thing is that the winner of this contest is going to be given an important mission. Mm-hmm. So Hercules wins and then he finds out what the mission is. And so the king comes up to him and he's like, oh, okay, you won. So your mission is you have to take my beautiful daughter Cassiopeia to Athens and you have to protect her along the way because he explains there is a whole lot of evil and mischief about out on the roads. And this is due to the wicked King Minos from the Isle of Thera, like monsters are coming from the island. And because of his evil daughter, Sybil Danning. But then I love, we get the intervention by the king's scheming advisor, who is this stammering nerd named Dorkon.
Yes. Yeah. Kind of a Donald Pleasancy presence to this guy.
Oh yeah. He's got a really great objection. So the king is like, yes, you will escort my beautiful daughter. And then the advisor is like, this man is a great warrior, yes. But how can we be sure he isn't part of the evil and mischief you mentioned? And the king's like, oh, that's a good point. We can't. but so they decide to test him further. And this is where we get the famous, labor of Hercules, the cleaning of the stables. And this it's the stables of Cybele. Oh, but so if you're not familiar with the myth, Rob, what's the basic outline of the cleaning of the stables labor?
Well, this is a clever Herc moment where you think, oh, well, this is just going to be a whole bunch of shoveling poop for old Hercules, and surely he's up for it, but there's a time constraint here. Even Hercules can't shovel this much poop. Well, what Hercules does instead is he diverts the rivers through the stable and clears out all the poop. And this is truly, this would not have been my first pick for a cinematic portrayal of one of the trials, but it's pretty awesome because, again, the stables look otherworldly and weird, and they look pretty foul. He diverts a river through it, and it's just, it's one of those great shots where you have a miniaturized set but full-scale water, so everything looks looks a little fake.
Uh-huh.
And
I love that.
And then we get the before and after, right? Here's water going through these awful looking stables. And then when the waters are done, everything is just sparkling white.
Right. It looks like a locker room or something.
Yeah.
And of course, along the way, Hercules falls in love with Cassiopeia, as you might imagine. He's he gets her to agree. He's like, hey, if I get all the poop out of these stables, you're going to agree to marry me. And she's like, well, okay. and then he does it and they kiss. And then Zeus shoots lightning out of his head and makes them fall asleep.
Yes.
I don't recall why, if Zeus explained why he did that.
I think he just wanted to move the plot along.
Right. So he shoots the lightning, the forehead lightning at them. They're knocked out, and then they get captured by the bad guys. And at this point, they're split up. Cassiopeia is taken off to the evil island of Thera to be a human sacrifice. And Hercules, they're like, oh, we'll take him out to the ocean. I think it's Sybil Danning who's like, we'll throw him in the ocean. He'll be eaten by sharks. But come on, he's Herc. He's fine. He just swims for a week and then gets to shore.
Yeah, it doesn't even encounter a shark. For a second there, it feels like, oh, we're going to get Herc versus a shark. No, they don't even mess with him.
And here's where we get that series of adventures with Hercules and the sorceress Circe. Mm-hmm. That's a tongue twister. Sorceress Circe. But anyway, when we first meet her, she's in like gnarly witch form, but then she regains her youth and vitality by drinking some of Herc's blood, which is great. And then we get all this backstory of how she lost some of her powers because the evil King Minos of Thera took away her magic, and she's got to get Herc to help her, recover some artifacts or something that will give her power back. There's just one screenshot I pulled out for you to look at, Rob, here, because it's just an example of one of the many side-splittingly unfortunate reaction shots of Lou Ferrigno where some other character's talking, but it's just showing us Lou Ferrigno's face. And I'm not sure if anybody was actually talking when they filmed this because he's not reacting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But even when he's not reacting, again, there is a certain charisma to Ferrigno in this, and it does shine through, but not in a way that makes the character feel too confident.
Right. No, it's more of a Ferrigno in this movie, I think, is likable, but like we said earlier, somehow it grows more out of his lack of screen charisma. He's just kind of all buddy.
Yeah, and even though he is created by the gods and has all this power, yeah, he's up against some really scheming elements here. He's up against evil kings and the manipulations of rival gods and beings from outside of space and time, and of course, three giant robots. There are going to be two additional robot battles. All of them basically have the same energy of Herc, like, poking things that are not on screen. It really makes you value even more just how amazing the work of Ray Harryhausen was.
Yes.
That, you know, he could have these amazing models that had this life to them, but also they were able to shoot these sequences in ways where it felt like human beings and monsters were occupying the same space. You never get that illusion in this picture.
No, the effects in this movie are not good, but I do think they're fun despite being bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there's more scheming by Minos and Daedalus leading up to the next big robot battle. Daedalus, I think, says, like, "Well, we're going to kill Hercules with my three-headed metal monster." And Minos is like, "Oh, another robot, huh? Well, the last one didn't do too great." But Daedalus is like, "This one spits cosmic rays of deadly fire." And then, and she says, "Do you know what that means?" Oh, and he's very impressed. He's like, "Oh, cosmic rays of deadly fire. Well, in that case, great." She's like, "Do you know what that means?" And then he says, they will be eliminated, disintegrated, not a trace."
Yes, yeah, yeah. Darth Vader says no to disintegrations, but Minos is like, "Yes, let's have some disintegrations."
And this is one of the funny parts where Minos is, for some reason, he just wants to see the monster grow just a little bit.
Yeah. He's like, "I'm paying for it. I want to see the monster grow a little bit before you send it down to Earth," where naturally, again, we kind of skipped over this, but entry into Earth's atmosphere will cause the robot to grow. Because that's just the natural order of things. That's science, and these guys love science.
Oh, but so Hercules and Circe have to face off against this monster, and so they sort of defeat it with something akin to the Perseus method going up against Medusa. They use a reflective shield to shoot the deadly cosmic rays back at the robot. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one where this is not Herc's own cleverness. Circe has to tell him what to do.
Yeah. But you have a lot of cool flashing lights in this sequence. It's very, very visually appealing.
Yeah, they're in a cave. There's a big three-headed metal dragon attacking them, shooting rays, and he's using the shield to reflect them. But anyway, after they win that battle, they end up moving on to what is one of my favorite visual moments in the movie, which is when Herc and Circe have to cross the river Styx to go to the Temple of Eternity, which is this giant skull mountain with caves for eyes and a mouth. Mm-hmm. And so you get the river, the boatman Charon, who's this creepy skull face. This scene I thought was actually pretty atmospheric and effective.
Yeah, I mean, our characters are going to hell here. They're going to Hades, and it feels good. Like a number of sequences here could be a straight up metal album cover.
After this, let's see. There are a number of other adventures. There's the one where Hercules has to push the pillars of the now so called pillars of Hercules apart to open the Mediterranean Sea. There's a great scene of bootstrap physics where they somehow access a chariot that I think would be pulled by a Pegasus, but the Pegasus isn't there. So, Hercules, what does he do?
Oh, this is great. Yeah. They strap, a boulder to the chariot. And then Hercules heaves the boulder through space. They jump into the chariot and the boulder that Hercules just threw pulls the chariot that they're now riding through space.
Brilliant. I love it. and also, so they like fly through space and then they fall in an ocean and then they swim to the harbor of Thera, the bad guy's island. And the harbor there has what looks like a robot colossus of Rhodes bestride the entrance to the harbor. So if you like zoom in on it, it's like the colossus, I think the actual Colossus probably was not straddling the entrance to the harbor, but it's often shown in art straddling the entrance. And so it's doing that in this image here, but it's a robot.
Yes. And there are pyramids back there and everything's green. It looks like we're at the, like on the Necron homeworld or something. It's trippy. And they're like, again, like three moons or suns in the sky in the background. So, this is clearly not even Earth. I don't know. This movie's very vague again with where things are happening, but this does not feel at all like our planet.
No, but I do love the way this part looks. And so we get a bunch of final confrontations. Hercules has to battle the third robot, which is like a robot centaur. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that battle being all that notable, except that
it's just more poking.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Cersei is unceremoniously killed, and she has one of those really funny lucid death things where she's like, oh, I'm dying. And then she just lucidly delivers some final dialogue and then goes, eh.
Oh, yeah. Well, remember, she was depowered. She lost her powers because when a sorceress falls in love, they lose their powers. So, ultimately, it's Hercules' fault for being just so lovably handsome.
Right. And there's a final confrontation where Hercules has to rescue Cassiopeia. He has to go into a volcano and fight the evil King Minos. So that sword comes back into there.
Oh my God. This sequence is so great because they're fighting on like a platform over the volcano where a phoenix is said to be captured. And Minos whips out like a rainbow light sword with which to murder Hercules. And at the time, and he's also like, hey, that's the Sword of Thebes back there. It's holding the phoenix in place. Nobody touch it. It's super important. So, of course, Hercules draws the Sword of Thebes, and then they get to sword fighting up there.
Who do you think wins? I mean, of course, Hercules wins. And then who is it who like ages rapidly and then turns into dust like in The Last Crusade? Is it Sybil Danning?
It is Sybil Danning, yes, because after Minos is defeated, she's like, you may have won, but I'll kill you. And she's going to throw a spear, but instead Herc throws the sword. She's impaled, falls, and we get that slow motion disintegration sequence, which is nice.
Oh, yeah, but it's such a happy ending because Hercules rescues Cassiopeia. They kill science once and for all, and then they escape from the burning island of Thera, and it's happily ever after.
Yeah, they embrace on the shore, and then they become a constellation in the sky. Uh-huh. It's perfect, absolutely perfect.
Take that, science.
All right. Well, this one was super fun. And yes, this is a very viewable film. If you subscribe to HBO Max, at least in the States, I'm never sure how these things work, you can currently find the first Hercules movie, the one we watched, on HBO Max in all of its beautiful, colorful glory. It has also come out on Blu-ray in recent years. So there's a very nice looking Blu-ray edition of that. And I think you can also still pick up a Hercules double feature DVD that includes both this film and the sequel, both Lou Ferrigno Hercules films in one DVD package.
Wait, if he already turned into a constellation, what's he going to do in the second one? Just twinkle?
I think they have to battle all the same characters again. Like basically has the same cast minus Sybil Danning. So I'm not sure exactly how it goes down, but I have to admit, I'm kind of interested to check it out now. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it out here. But we'd love to hear from everyone out there. Your thoughts on 1983's Hercules, your thoughts on, just any Hercules movie or Muscle Man movie in general, the legacy of Muscle Man movies. All of that is fair game. If you would like to check out other episodes of Weird House Cinema that publishes every Friday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed, we're primarily a science podcast with core episodes coming out on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but we do listener mail on Mondays. We do an artifact short form episode on Wednesdays, and on Fridays, we put most of the serious concerns aside and just talk about a weird film. I blog about these episodes at samudamusic.com, and if you use Instagram, I have set up an Instagram account for Weird House Cinema. Is just Weird House Cinema, so you can follow it there.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.